Hi, everyone. Welcome back for another episode. Again, thank you so much for your listening again. And as always, welcome back if you're a new listener. This episode is about the very famous, at least in Western Canada, I feel like, the Banff Springs Hotel. Now, one of the spirits at this location is very popular. It's a very popular story. In fact, she has a commemorative stamp and a commemorative coin. So this is the ghost bride of the Banff Springs Hotel. The other story that I'll be talking about today is a US location story. I haven't been able to get this out of my mind since I read about it years and years ago. This is the story of the insane monster Linda Hazard and the story of Starvation Heights. I would like to thank the representative that I spoke to at Banff Springs Hotel. She did answer me, and I was not expecting an answer, as I've heard that they do not like to talk about any haunting activity. So thank you so much to her. And now a quick reminder, please make sure to hit that subscribe or favorite button on whichever platform you choose to listen on, and please leave a rating. And actually, a very important thing to do as well is tell your friends. If somebody likes podcasts, or even if they don't like podcasts, tell them to listen to the Real Scary Podcast. Now, without further ado, let's get started. So we're going to start off with the Banff Springs Hotel. I think I'm going to leave my personal opinions until the end. I don't want to taint the story for all of you. Not yet. So the Banff Springs Hotel is located in Banff, Alberta. The town and hotel both reside inside of the Banff National Park. And when I tell you that it is stunning, I mean stunning. The hotel is nestled in the Rocky Mountains, and you need to look at the photo on the blog, and I think you will immediately understand why it's been called the Castle in the Rockies. Now, the hotel opened in 1888 and was actually built by Canadian Pacific Railway as a hotel in their group of Grand Railway Hotels. This is something I learned when researching this, and I had no idea. I didn't know it was part of Canadian Pacific Railway. There was a Calgary Herald article, and I'll link it in the blog, and it said that rooms were $350 a night and that the first season saw 1,500 guests. Now, an important thing to note is that this hotel was seasonal for a long time, longer than even I expected, actually. The winterization didn't occur until 1970. Another portion of the hotel was finished in 1914. This was a stone, concrete, and steel center wing and another wing. They were planning to demolish the original wooden structure to build a wing to match the new addition. However, in 1926, there was a fire and the original wooden wing of the hotel burned to the ground. The architect for the hotel update, I'll call it, was Walter Painter, and he was a chief architect for the Canadian Pacific Railway, the CPR. That center tower was approximately $2 million. The original hotel was built with one huge design flaw. The building was facing away from the mountains. So the design corrected this mistake, and the new hotel took full advantage of the magnificent view. There wasn't a lot of coverage in the papers at the time on the fire that demolished the original hotel, but I did find one, and it will be up on the blog for you to see. There's a rendering of the hotel at that time, and it explains very simply that a fire destroyed it. There was no indication of the cause or anything else. And maybe because they were planning on its demolition, it wasn't really seen as a big deal. The hotel supposedly reopened completely finished, and some articles state that it resembled a Scottish castle. So it reopened in 1928, and the visits only blossomed from there. People came from all over to experience the beauty of Banff and the luxurious experience of staying at the Banff Springs Hotel. Among the guests that came out in droves were actors, politicians, royalty, and dignitaries. King George VI and Queen Elizabeth during their 1939 royal tour, Marilyn Monroe, B. Bing Crosby and Ginger Rogers are some of the other big names who stayed there. There was a period during World War II that the hotel closed down between 1942 and 1945 to allow for employees to be available for the war effort. It opened back up in the 1950s, but it was apparently in pretty rough shape. It wasn't until, as I said, the 1970s that they decided they needed to keep the hotel open year-round and not just as the summer hotel. This really changed around the hotel's image. And in 2001, the hotel rebranded to the Fairmont Banff Springs as the hotel portion of the CPR had been purchased by the Fairmont Hotels and Resorts just 2 years prior. The current hotel truly still looks like a castle out of a fairy tale. It boasts just over 750 rooms, event spaces, restaurants, a swimming pool, tennis courts, bowling alley, and a 27-hole golf course. And of course, access to some amazing snow sport locations. So now let's talk about the supernatural element to this hotel. I mean, I think we've come to realize that hotels themselves are hotspots for activity. Since so many people come through a hotel in its lifetime, but especially hotels like this that have been around for 130 years, there are bound to be some stories. Now you know, the fact the hotel is partially constructed of limestone has my radar going berserk. I mean, where there's limestone, there is usually some sort of residual haunting. The most famous spirit is the Ghost Bride. She was commemorated on a stamp and a collector coin a few years back. So I would say, of all the stories, she's the most well-known, absolutely. So the legend goes like this. Sometime in the 1920s, though some stories do say 1930s, a beautiful bride was descending the hotel's stunning marble staircase and slipped on her dress and fell down the stairs and died at the bottom. Other versions say that she walked down the steps, which were lined with candles. Her dress caught fire and she fell and burned to death at the bottom of the stairs. Yet another version has the bride descending the stairs safely, but succumbing in the ballroom as she danced with her new husband. It has her dress catching fire on a candle and engulfing in flames. Now the story is murky, to say the least. And when I spoke with someone in the marketing and public relations area for Fairmont Banff Springs, she said the story of the bride is hanging in the stairwell in the mezzanine level one, and is available for guests to read. She said that they, quote, do not have any further information or paranormal claims to validate. So this is more than I expected, as I said in my intro, because I have heard the hotel is very tight-lipped about it. And I have to say also that this employee was completely pleasant to chat with, and I really do appreciate her answering me. Now here's my issue with this story. I really feel like it is not true. We know there was a fire in 1926, and though there was not much in the way of newspaper coverage, certainly the untimely death of a young woman on her wedding day, dying tragically, whether that be from a fall or from a fire, would have 100% been in the papers. I can't see it not making the papers at that time, and when I tell you I searched records, I spent countless hours on this case. Trying any keywords, searching different years of publications, trying to find anything, and literally reading through entire papers, and I found zero, nothing. I even took it a step further and searched for graves in the Banff Cemetery for a young woman who passed in the 20s or 30s who might fit this description, but I didn't come up with anything. And of course, maybe she wasn't from Banff. Maybe she wasn't buried in the Banff Cemetery. It just seems very unlikely there would be nothing in the papers. The other information that I have is through a source here in Alberta who I've spoken with for another upcoming episode. She is attached to the historian trade, I guess I will say. And we actually got talking a little off topic about the Banff Springs Bride. She too had done some research into the subject, and She told me that she came across an article from the late 20s, early 30s era, where it was said that the hotel actually made up the bride story for tourism. So I haven't been able to find that article, but I do believe her when she says that she found it. And I do believe what the article said. This is why I believe it. In the 1920s and 1930s, when the spiritualism movement was still very popular, why wouldn't the hotel want to capitalize on the movement and drive interested parties into Banff? And hey, if they ended up having an experience to tell their friends about, more tourism for the hotel. Now, of course, this is just my theory, is I believe that the ghost bride story is not true. I believe it was fabricated and has stayed and grown and is a legend of the hotel, which is really cool. I mean, it's still a neat thing for this hotel. However, I do believe that people have seen a woman in white or a cream gown. There are many, many sightings. Now you might be thinking, well, how can it be a fabrication and how can people still be seeing this? So what if the ghost bride didn't die there, but what if the woman is a result of the stone tape theory? She may very well even have been a bride or maybe just wearing a beautiful white dress. But either way, the energy on a wedding day is high and happy energy usually. And that could very well have left its mark in the building. I don't believe the bride is known to interact with people, so that just solidifies to me that people may just be seeing basically an old recording of this woman, whomever she is, descending the stairs, and maybe it was on her happy wedding day. I believe people see her dancing in the ballroom or see a woman dancing in the ballroom, and I believe that this would be a residual energy recording. So let me know what you think about this. Please let me know if you've had your own personal experience with the Bride of Banff Springs. The next spirit at the hotel is known as Sam the Bellman. There was a man who worked in the hotel, I believe, off and on for many years, throughout the 60s and 70s, and he apparently really loved his job. He's said to have even mentioned that he would be coming back to haunt the hotel when he passed away. Well, it appears that that was serious. That was a serious promise that he made. Many reports of a bellman helping guests have been heard over the years. One of the favorite stories that is usually always told with Sam is of two women who were having trouble getting into their room. They called the bell desk for assistance, but the bellman was really busy elsewhere, and it took him 15 minutes to arrive. When he came, he found the room unlocked, and the women said that the other bellman had come to help them. He asked them to describe the man, and they said that he was older, had a plaid jacket, and described basically to a T, Sam McCauley. They said that he had come and he had helped them with the door, and that he left just before this bellman had arrived. However, there was no elderly male bellman on staff at the time, working or not. Sam has been helping out guests, and when they go to tip him, he's gone. Cold spots are felt around the hotel, and especially on the 6th, 7th, and 9th floor, and that is attributed to Sam. Some people even believe that it's Sam's unseen hand that will open doors for guests. Now, this story has some merit to it, and again, I'm not saying it's 100% is or it is 100% not, but I did find a grave for a man by the name of Sam McCauley who passed in 1975. I did see in another blog as well a person claiming to be a family member who confirmed that he did work as a bellman at the Banff Springs Hotel and he did pass in 1975. They were correcting the blog that had claimed that he passed in 1976. And they were also spelling his name incorrectly. So it seemed to be a legitimate post to me. So I think that this haunting has weight to it. The last haunting story is of a specific room, and that room is 873. There's a legend that a family was murdered in this room, a man, woman, and child. Some versions of the story say it was murder-suicide, and the legend goes that the room had to be bricked off due to phantom screams and a mirror with bloody handprints that, despite efforts to clean, would never go away. So there are numerous images online where people will go searching for missing room 873 and have the proof that there should be a door there, but it's walled off. So I'll have some of these photos up on the blog. Yes, it does appear like there should be a door there, but the reason there isn't is pretty simple. The room during renovations was combined with another room to create a large two-room suite. So just like the bride, I searched high and low for any mention of a family murdered, and in fact, any murder, any death really that occurred in the hotel, and I found nothing. There are even some stories out there that the Stephen King book, The Shining, was based off of the Banff Springs Hotel. I feel like maybe that's where this story might have started. The description of the Overlook Hotel could easily bring up an image in your head of the Banff Springs Hotel, but it is not the same hotel that the book is based on. The hotel that Stephen King based The Shining on is the Stanley Hotel in Colorado in the United States. And fun fact, Stephen King did stay there and he did experience paranormal activity. And thus was born The Shining. So this last story obviously has a perfectly reasonable explanation. Now, maybe you can tell why I was sort of avoiding this location. It's tough because I don't want people to think that I'm discounting their experiences, because there are numerous at this hotel. And here's the thing, I completely believe that people have experiences here. I just think that the origin stories might not be completely accurate. So in an age where everyone's offended, I truly hope I have not offended anyone. That's not my intention. This hotel is as beautiful as it looks and sounds. And as someone who has been here, and even just to the town of Banff, please visit when you can, when it is safe to do so. It is stunning. And I do believe that this is a place where you could see or feel something that can't be explained. Of course, I'll have all of the information and directions up on the blog if you do want to visit in the future. The next story I'm going to talk about took place at a location in the United States. So I did this last season where I spoke about a couple of US locations. I believe it was in part one and two of Haunted Homes, just as an FYI. I heard of this story years ago and it's always stuck with me because it is insane. It's just wild sometimes to look back on medical fads and think, wow, I wonder why people thought that was a good idea. So this story begins with a woman born in Minnesota by the name of Linda Laura Burfield. Now, Linda grew up to be a published author and a doctor. And no, she didn't go to medical school. She obtained a license in Washington through an old loophole where people could be grandfathered in, basically for proving that they studied under another doctor. Linda supposedly studied under a doctor by the name of Edward Hooker Dewey, who promoted fasting. Now, fasting wasn't a unique concept, and even in today's world, in the right context, it could possibly help, and fasting is a thing. Linda wrote her first book in 1908 called Fasting for the Cure of Disease, and later another book called The Science of Fasting, where she spouted all sorts of crazy theories, one being, quote, "The sole source of bodily ills is impure blood. The cause of impure blood is imperfect digestion." She truly believed that the cure to every single ailment was fasting. Now, not fasting for 24 hours, like I say is popular now, or even 48 hours, but we'll get to that. Apparently, when her book was published in 1908, she had already killed one of her patients via her methods, quote unquote. I can't even say treatment because that would suggest she knew what she was doing. A coroner at this time in Minnesota determined the person's cause of death was as a result of starvation. He intended to have her prosecuted, but because she had no license, it made it very difficult to prove culpability. Linda then became Linda Hazard when she met her husband Sam. Sam came with his own baggage. He was a convicted bigamist, embezzler, forger, and failed military man. The two decided to make their way west, where Linda Hazard dreamed of opening a beautiful sanatorium in the country, While the large sanatorium was financially out of reach, Linda made do with a small home in Olalla, Washington. She opened her home as a sanatorium that she named Wilderness Heights. The locals eventually changed the name, calling it Starvation Heights. At this time, fad diets and treatments were really popular, and more often than not, the people that these programs attracted were wealthy people who were always looking for a way to stay on trend. Dr. Hazard's treatment was outlined in her book as such. The path to health was to let your digestive system rest through almost complete fasts for days at a time. During the fasts, the patients would consume small servings of vegetable broth. The reality and the hard truth of the program was that the term vegetable broth was generous. In reality, these people would be given a very small serving of tomato juice, and sometimes they were lucky enough to get a small tablespoon of orange juice. This wasn't just for a day or two. This was for weeks and even months that this went on. In addition to the small amount of sustenance given, patients would be subjected to enemas in the home's bathtub that would last for hours. They would also be subjected to massages where Lydia would essentially beat her patients on the head and back with her fists. Apparently, she would scream, "Eliminate!" while giving these massages. So while this obviously doesn't sound like a tranquil retreat, where you would relax and be cured of your ailments, many patients became much too weak to do anything if they even realized what was happening at all. People in town used to talk about the skeletal people coming out of the woods and asking for food or for help. Children used to be terrified of Dr. Hazard, and I'm sure the sight of a walking skeleton coming out of the woods would have been a source for terror for everyone. Now, some people did leave, and they would sing her praises anywhere they could. Few escaped, as I already said, but there were at least 15 known people, and many speculate even more, who simply never made it out of Starvation Heights. In 1908, Mr. Elgin Cox, Ida Wilcox, and Daisy Maud Hagland all perished under her quote-unquote care. Daisy left behind a 3-year-old. She fasted for 50 days under Dr. Hazard. I can't imagine enduring the Hazard treatment for almost 2 months. Unreal. In 1909, Blanche Tyndale, Viola Heaton, and Eugene Stanley Wakelin died at Wilderness Heights. Eugene died from a bullet in the head, and there's much speculation that Linda or Sam may have shot him. But of course, it's just speculation. 1910 saw the deaths of Maud Whitney, Earl Edward Erdman, L.E. Rader, and in 1911, 5 more: Frank Southard, C.A. Harrison, Ivan Flux, Lewis Ellsworth Rader, and Claire Williamson. The victims didn't end here, but the last name I mentioned would become a large part of Lydia Hazard's downfall. Claire Williamson did not come to the sanitarium on her own. She had her sister Dora with her. The Williamson sisters were wealthy and relatively healthy. They traveled a lot and they saw an advertisement for Linda's book in a newspaper. They had some minor ailments and were very interested in alternative medicine. The sisters sought out Dr. Hazard and signed up for the most beautiful treatment, which is what it was called. What the sisters, and I'm sure many other patients, imagined they would be taking part in was not at all what they would come to know. They were actually set up in an apartment in Seattle first. I believe this was an office space owned by the Hazards. Linda immediately began the sisters on her treatment of canned tomato broth, just 1 cup a day, and started their long enema treatments right off the bat, to which the women would often faint during. The sisters were eventually transferred to the Olalla home and were, at that point, only 70 pounds each. So you have to wonder if this was more a strategy about waiting until they were weak enough to control rather than just a space issue at her home. There was no large sanatorium being built at this time, so she must have known that these rich women may have left her small home immediately, realizing that it wasn't what she said it was. Anyhow, The Williamson sisters found themselves at Starvation Heights, and to top it all off, none of their family knew. They were always getting flack for following fads and what their family deemed silly trends, so they didn't tell anyone where they were going. Now, the sisters at this point would have been severely fatigued, would not have been able to walk far, if at all, and would have been in severe pain. The sisters were not allowed to send or receive mail, but somehow, Claire was able to get a letter out to their childhood nanny and family friend in Australia. Now, the actual letter was apparently so strange and difficult to even understand that the family friend rushed to Olalla to find out what was going on. When she arrived, she was told that Claire had passed away. One thing I forgot to mention is that good old Dr. Hazard would do her own autopsies. Yeah. An untrained woman would do autopsies over her bathtub with the bodies on an ironing board. She would determine cause of death, because that's not hard, is it? No, not at all. She would often not even fill out the paperwork or even make a report to the coroner. So when Claire passed away, she weighed less than 50 pounds. And the cause of death, as determined by Dr. Hazard, was cirrhosis of the liver. I read in another article that the family friend was told by Sam Hazard that it was due to drugs that were given to her as a child. When Dora was shown her sister's body, she did not recognize her. Her face, hair color, and size was not even the same. It's believed that the Hazards may have been in cahoots with a local funeral home to switch the bodies with ones of healthier weights. Now, this was never proven, but it was a theory, and knowing what the Hazards did, I wouldn't be surprised. The family friend did catch a look at Dora and was horrified to see a woman who weighed about 50 pounds. In her efforts to remove Dora, another layer of this situation came to light. It was revealed that Linda Hazard had been appointed executor of Claire's estate and was Dora's guardian as well as power of attorney. They told Dora that she was insane and unable to take care of herself. It was not easy for the Williamson family friend to do anything, but she notified Dora's uncle. He came to rescue his niece, and with the help of British Council, she was removed from the Hazard's care. Now, there's a book called Starvation Heights by Greg Olson. I will put the links to his book on the blog. It's really, really interesting. I highly recommend you check it out. In this book, there are some photos of Dora, and I will try to get those on the blog as well. It's unreal. She was days from death, I'm sure. Now, you all may be thinking out there, there's no way this was the first time that they stole from their deceased patients, and you would be correct. It's believed that this was the case with any one of their victims who had anything that they could take. One wealthy victim died of starvation, leaving only $70 to his family. The Hazards were found to have forged documents when they couldn't coerce the victims to do so on their own. If you'll remember, Sam Hazard had embezzlement and forgery as part of his rap sheet. There were four more deaths at the sanitarium, and Linda Hazard was finally taken to court for the murder of Claire Williamson. It was a circus in court, and many speculations were flying. There was even talk that Linda's dalliance in spiritualism had given her supernatural abilities to hypnotize her patients. Now, Dora did survive, and she was one of the witnesses on the stand. There were other nurses who had been employed at Wilderness Heights. They were employed there at different times, but they all gave statements of hearing patients, and especially Claire and Dora, screaming in pain during treatments. Dora's bones protruded so severely that she would scream in pain just to sit down. In the end, Linda was sentenced to hard labor at Walla Walla Prison. After 2 years, she was released, and for some reason was pardoned by the governor. Now, she did have a lot of supporters, along with a lot of people who also thought she was a monster. Once she was released, she and her husband moved to New Zealand, where she had a large number of supporters, and she worked there for a number of years. She came back to the United States and back to Olalla to build her dream sanatorium. Though, because she lost her medical license, she called it a school of health to get around any red tape. The institute actually burned down in 1935, and what is still left to this day is a concrete tower and some of the foundation ruins. The last person to die of Linda Hazard's effed up treatment was a woman in 1938 by the name of Linda Hazard. That's right. She took ill and practiced her own treatment, which ended up killing her. The Wilderness Heights house was actually purchased and lived in by a family as they built another home on the property. They experienced some really creepy things while there, strange noises and feelings. When the mother of the family was alone in the home and in the kitchen, she was cooking away and she turned around and all of the kitchen chairs and two from the living room were pushed against the bathroom door. The same bathroom where countless autopsies were done. Many psychics and ghost hunting teams and TV shows have been in the property. One psychic said that in the attic, there were numerous victims that were still afraid to move. Even in death, they were just sitting on the ledges. So that's really creepy. There were countless EVPs supposedly caught on tape as well. Walking out on the property where people believed she buried many victims, EVPs were caught saying, "Dig us up." The home was eventually demolished by the family, and I don't blame them at all. The land might still be tainted by the pain and the horror that occurred. I think it was actually one of these ghost hunting shows years ago where I first heard of this location. I will do my best to find where the remains of the larger sanitarium are, and I will put that up on my site. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Don't be shy. Let me know what you think of these locations and their stories. Had you heard of Linda Hazard before? Make sure to follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Real Scary Podcast. Check out the blog for this episode at realscarypodcast.ca and feel free to email me at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. Please show me some love by sharing my show and leaving me a rating. If you do visit these places, please let me know how it goes. I'd love to hear your comments and stories, so continue to share them with me. I am currently taking suggestions. It can be anywhere in the world, but send me your suggestions for season 3. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.